I Okay, go ahead and exchange papers, then we'll take this. First set, of course, 2 points each for the English ones, answers, and 3 points each for the Hebrew answers. 1 point for every spelling error, and half point for Doug H. Okay. Number one, Goy, the people or nation. Number two, Gentiles, I don't know. Number two, Katsir is harvest, crop, or time of harvest. Any of those would be fine. Harvest, crop, or time of harvest. Number three, Katsaf, to become angry. To become angry or be angry. Number four, Eglah means heifer. Number five, Gidi means kid. K-I-D meaning a goat type kid. Number six, Zayat is olive tree or olive. Olive tree or olive. Number seven, Ko, thus. General, it's generally referring to what follows. You put that there, but thus. And then number eight is time or appointed time. Either one. And number nine, Hifkave to hide oneself. Hifkave to hide oneself, and Hithnabe to prophesy. The tenth one, prophesy. Any questions on any of those? All right. And I'll erase that part. What's that?
2 points.
Yeah, 2 points for all of these. And there might be some partial credit if they're close, but not right, or something like that. If there is any question in your mind, then put a question mark on it. Okay, number one, to arouse or stir up. Number two, to take one stand or station oneself. Try it off.
I think he got saved.
Yeah, 1 point for a vowel point and a half point for a digation.
And a letter is?
A letter is 1 point. So, maximum three wrong. 1 point per letter, 1 point per vowel point, and half point per Doug H. Uncircumcised with the Arel, Ayin Reish Lama. Common sincerity pattern. Sacrifice, Zion, Faith, Zedach. You don't need to mark the stress, but it is a penultimate stress. Zevach. To hide or conceal, kifed, kav, yurik, po form, and theory with faith there, kifed. To rule, mashal, name, comment, shin, asad. Mashal.
Greg had Malak.
Malak. Yeah, that's.
It's the rule in the Honda.
Yeah, I think that may have been the reason I put the note on there. Yeah. Object was Dave. Because I didn't want you to get. Was the other one in the same list, too?
No. It's not an object with Dave.
It's in general.
The other one had an object of Behor.
Well,
okay. You're still technically right, though, because the object could have been Beh. Leave a question mark on that.
Okay.
Anybody else do that? Okay. Sometimes it's hard to. It'd be one thing, I could say, well, that one wasn't on this list, but that's. You know, if your mind is recalling something from before, it's the same thing. I'm going to give you some credit for that. So we'll see what I'll take a look at it. You can pray for mercy. Okay. 100 is Me'ah, name, cherry, olive, quiescent, olive, what comes here? May a deed, or act, or work. From the verb asa, participle derivation. Ma'asa, and to pray, the hispile verb here. Hispaleo. Don't forget the negation along with there. For the half point. There's a negation to pay there also. It's baleo. And then to swallow, bala. Ryan. That's it. So go ahead and score the paper on Eric's. Just leave a question at the top. Of the 50, right? Yeah, 50 points possible. Same as always. Only one more of these to go. After you've seen your paper and make sure that the edition is correct, you can pass them to the front here. I'll just collect them across the front. Before we go into back into the lessons, let's talk about the test for next week. This will be grammar and translation, and this one will have grammar on it because of these hofal and hispile forms. And the suffix itself, we've already passed this. Let me tell you exactly what to expect. There will be some translation on it, but it'll be shorter because we've got lots of other stuff. Not a lot, but a little bit more than you've had. So it's lessons 49 to 52. So let's go back and take a look at 49, and we'll make a bit of a review-like thing here. But I'll just kind of tell you what to expect. Have we gone through and reviewed this? I don't think we really have. This will be kind of an informal review and explanation of what's going to be on the test. Lesson 49, the hofal, what you need to be familiar with is the forms of shamaz here in the hofal. So your paradigm, starting at the bottom of page 243, the first column there, you've got hoshmaz, hoshmada, hoshmata. Now, they don't give you the full paradigm, so you'll probably want to fill out that paradigm the rest of the way. They give you what the start of it is, and you can figure out the rest just from the analogies to what you already know with the call. So you may want to do that. You may just want to write out your paradigm in complete just for that verb. And the imperfects at the top of the next page, yoshmaz, toshmadi, toshmazna, so forth, you can fill out the rest of that paradigm. The participle also is there. So be familiar with the paradigm for the hofal of shamad. And as far as meanings, it's just the passive of the hifil. Since we've already covered the categories of the hifil, about all you need to know is that it is the passive of the hifil. Other than that, there isn't anything grammatical in that chapter we need to worry about. Okay. Then in lesson 50, the hif pile, same thing there. We'll just take the regular verb here, gadal. You know the hif pile forms of gadal, and that's your first column on page 249 there. And there they do write out the full paradigm, first two columns actually. So that's from gadal, and be familiar with the paradigm for that. So you'll need to be able to construct the Hebrew forms on this too. In other words, I'll give you the parsing and you tell me what the form is, write the form out. So it will be in the harder direction. What's that?
I don't want to be fired.
Yeah, all right. Well,
At least I'm telling you just exactly what you can expect. Then there's five categories of meaning for the hith pile. And just like before, you need to be familiar with those five categories. You've got the reflexive, do something to yourself, reciprocal, to do something to one another. Indirect reflexive, which is something like the middle voice in Greek, where you're doing something to benefit yourself, etc. And then iterative, back and forth type of an idea, or continuous, and denominative. Just looking like a noun, in other words. Apparently, it's the idea of making a verb out of a noun. Then, the hardest probably of all is this lesson 50. Well, the call passive, don't worry about lesson 51. All these other verb types, don't worry about any of that. Nothing of that. Nothing on 51 will be on the test. That's just kind of a catch-all for everything else. So, since it's almost all the unusuals, I'm not going to have you worry about that. So, nothing on that. And as far as the numbers, don't worry about that. That would be just a lot of memory work. And you don't see them often enough to justify it. You can easily look them up. So that'll give you a little bit of mercy. Oh, how they list them. That's a good question. I don't know if they'll list them all together. You probably have to look up each word. I don't recall now. I don't think I've ever really looked up a number there, but I would guess that's the way they do it. In other words, the analytical does require you to have some grammatical understanding. So you need to know enough grammar to know how they put the number together in the sequence, but the actual literal words you... And you could, you know, if the question comes up in exegesis on numbers, you can just refer back to Lambden here, too. And that'd probably be faster for you that have been through it than it would be to go through the concordance like that, or the lexicon. Okay, so don't worry about that for the test. Then on lesson 52... we had the object suffixes with the first two forms, with the third person masculine singular and the second person masculine singular. And you will need to be familiar with these verbs, just the regular verb under the call in the PL and hifil, just the first verb in the column there, shamar for the call. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you an English phrase, you know, he observed them or something like that, and you have to translate that into Hebrew. So, but those phrases I'll give you are of these three verbs. Shamar, meaning to observe. The first one under PL, kiddesh, meaning to seek. And this first one under the hifil, hishmid, meaning to destroy. So I'll give you either observe, seek, or destroy in various, you know, he did to them or they to him, whatever, whichever forms. Now, of course, it'll only be he forms or you masculine singular forms. There's only two that you have.
Bikesh, not
Kadesh. Bikesh, yeah. Bikesh. Oh, I probably said Kadesh at first. No, Bikesh, I'm sorry. I thought it sounded strange to sanctify it. Okay, it's Bikesh. Bikesh. Okay, Kadesh would have worked fine too, but we'll use the one they got here. Bikesh, meaning to seek, and Hishmid, meaning to destroy. First one under Hifil. So, this way you'll get to see how it works for all three of those. But we won't deal with any irregular verbs. Just three, those three verbs specifically will be the only ones you'll need to know. Now, you'll have to be responsible then for essentially what the paradigm in section 185 does, the suffixes as they're attached to third person masculine singular, and then paradigm in section 186, the suffixes attached to the second person masculine singular. And what you might do, I don't know what's faster for you, but rather than try to memorize this chart, I won't ask you this chart, these three charts, A, B, and C down here. I'm not going to ask you for those. So just know the forms, you know, and I don't know what's easier for you, just to look at those forms and memorize those, or to go back to this chart, remember which one of these it is, you know, it's up to you. But since the endings of the... Right. Only second person masculine, third person masculine singular for the subject forms. Then the objects could be any one of the ones that you see in the paradigm there. Right. Yeah, both of them are using the same suffix set. So for this test, you might just memorize that suffix set. And if you remember the rules as to how the vowel points change, I think the tricky thing, perhaps the most tricky thing, is to remember that you've got a comment instead of a pasach on that second syllable, and then you've got the first syllable reduced to shua. So if you get that pattern, if you can, for example, if you just look at shamar there, page section 185, you just look down the whole column, and you've got the same thing in the first two syllables. So if you just remember that pattern, I think that'll be, you know, just look for what you can in common. The same with the second person masculine singular, it's always shua pathak for the first two syllables in all the forms. And then just learn your endings and you have it. Yeah, right. Yeah, it is kind of like the Segula pattern, sure. Yes, for plural. Oh, for the whole fall, all you need to know is just that it's passive of hifil. So in other words, I'm not going to go through and ask you all the range of hifil again. In other words, we already covered hifil and all the different categories there. So whole fall is just the passive of the hifil. That's... Oh, don't worry about that. I'm only going to be dealing with forms here in this quiz. So there are some complications there as far as when you have a double object construction and so forth. Yeah, don't worry about that for now. Try to make it as simple as possible. We did have a lot of detail in this chapter, so I'm going to try to whack it down a little bit. And then your translation section will be shorter than the past, but it'll still be on those. Let's see. I'm wondering if I could almost give you a hint. Well, I was going to try to make it a little easier for you by telling you which chapters I'm going to... Yeah. That would save you a little bit of study on the rest of it. It may not help that much. Well, maybe I'll go ahead and tell you. I'll reduce it a little bit here, your total domain of study. Lesson 49 and lesson 52 are the two areas that I'm going to draw from on your reading. The one on the evils of kingship and the one on the Samson and the riddle, the first section we had on that. So you can eliminate 50 and 51 then as far as having to review the reading there. That'll save you a little bit of work. Right, that's what I'm doing. I'm gonna take that time and apply it to these third forms. Since you do have a lot of detailed forms this time. 49 to 52 is what the test is on, and the reading, just 49 and 52, are what I'm going to draw from. And it won't be the total thing, of course, but I'm going to draw a section out of a selection from chapter 49's reading and a selection from chapter 52's reading, but not from 50 or 51. So you can save yourself the time of reviewing the 50-51 reading. Okay. Any other questions? What's liable to be on the quiz? That's next Wednesday. We have that one set for, don't we? I think the Greek one's on Thursday. To keep it all straight. Okay. Well, that being done, if there's any other questions, we can go over them on Tuesday as you're reviewing and find any problems, difficulties, we will consider them then. Okay, we just about finished up this lesson 53. And somebody had just read it in Escape by the Bell from having to translate it. Who was that? Doug? Okay. Good memories in here. So why don't you go ahead and you can read it again if you want, just to pick up where we were and then translate. That's verse 14.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, that's star. Mm-hmm. Okay, it's Oyave. Oyave, remember? Enemies. That's Oyave. Okay.
Except spurn me, spurn the enemies of Yahweh in this matter. Also, the son born to you, dying shall die.
Okay. Well, yeah, pretty graphic. All right, this first phrase, except that spurning you is spurned or scorning you is scorned, this, let me check here. What are you doing here? We've got an infinitive absolute, so that's the right construction here. The his note here, Oyave may have inserted an early date to prevent the verb Nates from having Yahweh as its direct object. So instead of saying spurning Yahweh, you spurned the enemies of Yahweh, or caused the enemies of Yahweh to spurn or scorn. I think that the way I had it written was, surely you have caused the enemies of Yahweh to scorn in this thing. Did somebody look up this verb and what its sense was? That's a critical thing. Does it mean to cause, to scorn?
It's a PL.
So
we could take a positive.
Yeah, that's the thing I had down. And,
so if you say, for instance, well, talking to Quran, you cross the enemies.
Right.
Or,
yeah, that's the sense I seem to see, is that you're causing the enemies of Yahweh to spurn in this thing, or to scorn. In other words, you're giving a rotten testimony to the world. And so, surely you're causing the enemies of Yahweh to scorn or spurn in this thing. And that would eliminate any problem that this artificial problem that he's generated here. And also, the son born to you will surely die, or surely the son born to you will die, or dying he will die. Did someone do a word there, look up that verb? I don't know if they just gave it to you in the vocab or what. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is. Due to the sound effect.
Mm.
And that happens
when
the mention
is in the PL of grammar. Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay. Did they give the meaning as a causative? The PL?
No, not in there.
Oh, not in his dictionary. Okay. Okay. That's the thing. There may be. In other words, if he's going to go non-causative, that's probably why he's made this remark about Oyaves being stuck in there. If you make it causative, then the Oyave fits very well. So we'll leave it up to you when to translate, but I put it down, surely you have caused the enemies of Yahweh to scorn in this thing. That seems to fit the whole idea and everything very well, too. Okay, in verse 15 then, and we're up to Peter. That's a short one. Finish it out. Yeah. Okay.
Can't go wrong. And he went and he gave to the house of his God. No.
Okay, Nathan went to his house. Yeah, Nathan went to his house. Yeah, that was the only thing I was thinking of. You might confuse Nathan with the verb. But that's what his name means. Okay. Yeah, that's the only difference, yeah. Although you have that verb form followed by another verb form, it'd be awkward. Okay, any other questions on these sections? Lesson 54, you get a little bit of reprieve. There's no reading on that one, no reading section. So we'll give you a few of the translation sections, section ones instead, but it'll be a shorter lesson. I don't know why he did that. He's going to give you a whopper, though, in the to make up for Solomon's Prayer in lesson 55. So. Yeah. So there's compensation. Yeah, really. If they know it, probably will. Especially when you see the kind of material we're going to deal with in that chapter. And the clause relationships, and we get kind of sticky. Yeah. The prayer is going to be full. It's going to be loaded. And then there's going to be kind of an analysis. We'll go through here some illustrative passages from Samuel and Job and so forth as part of the lesson. And we'll go through that too.
That's strange.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it isn't 37 verses. Okay, right?
I was wondering, we talked about in Greek how, Paul probably liked the hardest Greek and found it simple. Have you noticed anything in Hebrew? Any more difficult than the
others? I guess everybody thinks it's also difficult. Maybe that's not that difficult, but you're
the poetic
stuff. Yeah, it's the style there. The poetic style, you get a lot more disjointed things. That might be a factor. Some of your more complicated prophecies too, just because of the subject matter involved.
You don't have any context.
Yeah, right. That's precisely it. The context is, some things depend on context. With narrative sequence, you probably got the easiest, because you've got a lot of things to pick up on. With prophecy and with the Psalms and poetic style, you've got the least to pick up on, and so that makes it most difficult. But I think it's not so much that the Hebrew per se, the words that are used are more difficult. It's more that you don't have the same kind of context to go by, and things are a little bit more choppy and disjointed. In prophecies, lots of times you get things going back and forth between this person speaking and then that one speaking and that one speaking, and you kind of, it's hard to ferret it out sometimes. Plus, when you consider the complications of the well consecutive series and series relationships and clause relationships, that's where you run into most difficulty, I think. But as far as narrative, most of them start out with Genesis. That's probably one of the easier, probably the Pentateuch has got, as easy as it gets. That would probably be another good one. Yeah, that would probably be a simple one. You don't have a lot of complicated theology, and you've got a good historical narrative story. That'd be a good one. Look, I've seen that too. So,
I think maybe Solomon is always with it. Maybe it's a complex Hebrew.
Song of Solomon. Probably I say it's going to be the similar problems that you have with prophecies and things, especially when you get things symbolic and so forth. One of the problems that you run into is words in Hebrew that are used as symbols are sometimes hard too, because you're dealing with things back at that time, the names of objects or kinds of fruit or kinds of this or that or animals or things that are sometimes hard to track down exactly what the range of it was. So they get to be a little troublesome. But most of those kinds of problems are not so much complicated grammar. Grammar-wise, you're probably not going to see much difficulty except for the lacks of places where you don't have the good context to follow it with.
I would say places like in Proverbs, would it really matter there how you translate the word?
It's not going to matter too much as far as the impact, yeah. If it's a maxim, it's going to be true yesterday, today, and forever. So you've got that factor to consider. It's when it's in prophecy, especially, where that becomes a problem. Is this a statement about a historical event that happened, or is it a statement that's intended to be in the future? Or is it the whole thing in a past tense narrative because God is projecting this whole thing into the future and is viewing it from that standpoint? Or is it written just out and out in the future, and there's lots of variations that take place there, and that's what causes some of the problems. I'm trying to think too. There seems like one other area I was going to mention of difficulty. Oh yes, in Daniel and parts of Jeremiah and parts of Ezra, where you get some Aramaic sections, that could be a problem. Yeah, it's just one verse. Yeah, Daniel, you've got several chapters. And was it Ezra? Probably got portions of it. So there you're probably just going to have to rely upon your analyticals and things to go through that. It's not really worth the time to go and take a whole section and cover the variations. There's not that much difficulty. Most of the script is the same, and your basic grammar is the same. But you're going to see some variations in things like construct forms, plural forms, things, you know, as Elohim instead of Elohim, for example, for the plural. And there's things like that that will happen. Yeah.
Studying the last chapters of the Sutta, there were a couple of times where there were Aramaic verbs, forms.
Right. Yeah, the suffixes were some of them are similar and some of them are different, and some of the patterns are different too. Yeah. And there, and see, it's not worth your while to try to learn a paradigm for an Aramaic. You just, you know, trust the lexicographers on that. Mm-hmm. So that's about the size of it. You'll find it doesn't seem to matter where you plunk yourself down. You, I mean, once you get used to Hebrew, it all seems to flow pretty well, and you recognize things pretty well. And so I haven't really noticed anything.
I think vocabulary is probably one of the
biggest. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because your grammar is, Hebrew grammar is really basically quite simple. The grammar is. If you ignore now all the vowel point endings and things on the verb forms and so forth, the grammar itself and the way the words are put together is really quite simple. And that's part of what makes it difficult, is because its simplicity requires a dependence on context. And then when you don't have the kind of context you need, that's where you get difficulty. But it's not so much because the words themselves are presenting any real problem. But then above that is vocabulary. And you can't hope to, you know, memorize all the words and keep your vocabulary constantly perfect. Yeah, you'd have to almost live it, you know. And it's not worth their effort to do that. You've got enough vocabulary going through Lambden. He's got a pretty good complete vocabulary by the time you get through it. You've had enough familiarity, so you've got good recognition for a lot of things. And so what's important about that is you need to have enough vocabulary to know where you're at in the sentence. In other words, you may not know every word, but you know this is a verb and this is a verb, and you pick up this word, you pick up this S, and you know that's the object mark, and you know where everything's at. You can tell what are nouns and what are verbs and what are particles and so forth, what are adjectives, what the prepositions are like. You've got a structural format, and then the details you can fill in pretty easily. But if you don't even know whether you're looking at a verb or not or anything else, you're lost. You're up and down. Yes.
And there were
books
in the
yeah.
Most common Hebrew words.
Oh yes, okay. I think I've got the little thin one.
It's divided quite good because
it
tries to get all the cognates together.
Sure. Yeah, if you would like, you know, to further your vocabulary study, that would probably be one of the most intelligent approaches after you've gone through Lambden. He's got, in a book like this, where you're dealing with readings, he's got to give you some vocabulary. Some of it is, most of it is most common, but sometimes he's got to give you some things less common just because that's the reading he's going to give you. And so he's got a little bit of compromise there. But some of these other books, I think, would be real helpful that way if you're trying to maximize your effort. Okay. As far as your verb paradigms, once you've been through them and you learn to recognize, when you're translating, you can recognize the forms and the endings. That usually is sufficient. You may need to review it once in a while, especially forms that are not so common. Third person forms are pretty common. Second person plurals and feminines, those are the ones you don't see very often. So those ones, that if you run across one, you may not recognize it, having not seen it for a while. Okay, lesson 54. Object suffixes on the imperfect. When the form of the imperfect ends in a consonant, the suffix seri or segol nun is added before the object pronoun. Thus, yishmor plus seri or segol nun plus ni becomes yishmoreni or yishmoreni or yishmoreni with a double n at the end. So I don't know why he keeps going back to these. I mean, this is lesson 54. I think we should dispense with those transliterations by now. Anyway, it means he will observe me. The imperfect he will observe the third person masculine singular and then the first person common singular suffix. Because of various contractions, however, it is simpler to learn the suffixed elements as a unit. So, but he's just giving you the philosophy of it now. Basically, most of your imperfect endings, majority of them end in a consonant. And in other words, there was no suffix attached to it. It was mostly prefixal. Now, some of them have suffixes too, the shurek, we'll get to that later. But in order to carry the suffix, they're putting a vowel in between here, and it's either going to be a segol or a seri. and then if it's a goal, you'll have another a nun attached to it. So then the suffixes, two categories here, two variants, and the number one and the number two essentially differ basically in this fact that the number ones have the sagol nun and the number two has the tseri. And the nun sometimes assimilates. So you get the doubling for any, and then echa, you maybe think of that as having a nun assimilated, I don't know. Either that or an exception to the rule, one of the two. And then you've got enu, enna, enu, for the rest of the forms that you'll see there. Then in the column two, it's any, so you've got an option for the first person singular, any or any. And for your second person feminine singular, they don't have a masculine singular one there. So some of these split up. In other words, there's only one form for the masculine singular, and then there's one form for the feminine singular, the echa, and then the eich. And then for the third person masculine singular, you've got two forms again, enu and ehu. So the third person masculine plural and feminine plural, aim and ain, there's only those forms there. So neither paradigm is complete in itself. Forms of either column may be used with no difference in meaning. Excluding for the moment the imperfects of verbs from root 3 hey, we may distinguish those whose stem vowel is reducible, as in yishmor becoming yishmaru. In other words, that cholom there, yishmor, in the paradigm becomes yishmaru, you shorten it down to a shawa, which includes most call and pl verbs. Most calls and pls in the imperfect get that shortening of the stem vowel. And whose stem vowel is not reducible, mainly call verbs from hollow roots and hifil verbs. Of course, the hifil's got the hirik yos, and the hollow ones have got that unchangeable long vowel in there, so those aren't getting reduced. When the stem vowel is cholam or tseri, the same reduction takes place as in the main paradigm. In other words, when you add this object suffix onto an imperfect form whose stem has a cholam or a tseri, those are both long, changeable long vowels. So they will reduce to shwa. And they'll do the same thing they did when you added one of the suffixes on the imperfect. Like yishmaru there was one of the imperfects that has a suffix, and the cholam shortened down to shwa. Same thing happens if you were going to put an object suffix on. So yishmareni, he will observe me. From yishmor plus suffix ani, it's yishmareni, you get the shortening again. Under the mame, you have a shwa instead of a cholam. So it's the same kind of shortening that occurs when you added another suffix on to in the regular paradigm. Yitanu, they will give, and yitaneni, he will give me. Same thing happens there. Under the tau, you get the shawa. But when the stem vowel is pathak, this is not reduced, but lengthened to commas before the accented syllable of the suffix. Remember, there were certain types of imperfects that we called pathak imperfects. A lot of them was because of the three guttural. If it was a three guttural, you got a pathak and the imperfect, and there were some of them that got it anyway that, you know, we didn't know why. But yishma here is an example. Yishma, that becomes yishma'u, so it normally shortens down, but when you put the suffix on it, it becomes yishma'eni. Yishma'eni, and notice that under the main, you've got a full comments there. So that one, instead of shortening, when the object suffix is on, it lengthened. So these are little complications that probably will not prevent you from recognizing a form, but they might cause a problem in forming the form. Read carefully through the representative forms given below to be sure that this point is clear. Okay, so if it's a pathak type imperfect, that's where you tend to have this problem, where it's instead of shortening down to shawa, the pathak lengthens to kamat before these suffixes. So it's doing something different than it did in this normal paradigm. The imperfect plural forms in shurik take the suffixes given in column B. By the way, maybe I'll just tell you what the assignment is on that, so once we get through this, we can flow into it before I go any further here. Part A, 1, 4, 8, 12, and 15. Part A, number 1, number 4, number 8, number 12, number 15. Part B, 1, 4, 8, 12, and 15 also. Part B, number 1, number 4, number 8, number 12, number 15. And Part C, same thing, 1, 4, 8, 12, and 15. 1, 4, 8, 12, and 15. And that's it. So you can get prepared for that.
No, nothing in D, then.
Nothing in D. No, I'm still going to. The reason I left off doing the D ones, I'd like to if we had time, but those take lots of time, as you well know, because to correct them, I have to go through and spell, you know, all the complicated words and so forth. And if we had luxurious amounts of time that we did, you know, then I'd love to do it. But what I'd like to have is an answer book or something that, you know, we could do it, and then you just have that. They didn't make one up for this book that I'm aware of. So I may be considering making one up if we decide to stick with this book for the future. I haven't seen anything better yet. That I may make mine up and do it that way, but we'll see. Do they? Okay. We're forced to stick with it. Well, if somebody comes up with something better, I may switch. But so far, there's nobody who's got anything that I've seen that's comparable to this for teaching for a class like this. It's just it's really good. In spite of the shortcomings we've had, if we had a different book, you would have had a lot more complaints and lots more groans coming up from Egypt, as it were. Okay. Or Jerusalem, that's probably better. Yeah, no Egypt here. Okay. All right, let's go back then to what we were looking at, page 272. I'm at the first indentation at the top of the page here. The imperfect plural forms in Shurik, Yishmeru, Tishmeru, etc., take the suffixes given in column B, because B ones were, you know, the ones you added onto vocalic. So same kind of thing happens as happened back there, and then he'll list that. So if column B back on page whatever that was, 260. Yeah, right. So post vocalic unstressed. And so you see the pattern here, Yishmeru, Yishmeruni, is your suffix, and same would be Tishmeru, Tishmeruni, etc. Okay. And if it's Yishma'u, it'd be Yishma'uni, you get that comments again there, just in these forms, just like you did before. Even in these forms, the pathak vowel of the stem is restored. So it's not Yishma'uni, but Yishma'uni. Pronunciation isn't a whole lot different anyway. You usually run those things together so fast that there isn't a problem. It's a vocal schwa versus a regular vowel. Doesn't sound too much different anyway. Okay, so there's the examples in the call, PL and Hifil, of what happens to these various forms. And those, by now, I think you're familiar enough to be able to see what's happening. Another comment is made down here. The distinction between short, jussive, or converted, and normal imperfects is not retained before pronominal suffixes. So the pronominal suffixes basically are going to be attached to the longer forms. You don't have these apocopated forms or shortened up forms, jussive forms. When the jussive form would have been different than the imperfect form. When you put the suffixes on, apparently they're going back to the imperfect form, the longer form. So you see an example here. If you had Wayashmeith Otho, you've got a kind of a shortened form here from the Yashmeith, you know, to destroy. Hishmeith was the perfect form. Yashmeith, you had a Hirik Yod in there, and the jussive form shortened that down to a Tseri, so you had Wayashmeith. But when you're going to put an object suffix on it, you go back to the full long form, and the Hirik Yod comes back. In other words, you're building this from the regular imperfect form, not from the shortened jussive form. Now, not all verbs have a shortened jussive form. Some of them do, some of them don't. So this would only apply to the ones that do. Okay, that's our second bell. We'll stop there and continue this next Tuesday. And then if there's any more review necessary or questions on the test necessary, we'll take those on Tuesday as well. And the last lap on this book here. I'm thinking about that. I don't know. I'm going to have to kind of see if I can find some if there's material that I feel is worthwhile. I may be considering some things, some more ramifications concerning clause relationships and a little more fine detail. I'll think about it. If it's enough, if I feel like it's enough that it's worth taking some time with, we'll do that. Otherwise, generally what we're going to be doing is going from the text. We'll start in the book of Genesis, and we're going to start doing some translating right from the text. Yes? Yes, that's one of the ones I'm considering. Because Yeah, because he's dealing mainly with syntax like that and dealing with his, the problem is if we, I want to try to do it in such a way that we get glean some of the best out of it and not get labored down in the details, because if you do, you could spend easily the rest of the semester just going into details on that. So we'll I'm not familiar with his, so I think we Yeah, we may do some special things on that, and we are open to, some of you guys are doing some studies on plurals, or you know, from some of the other classes. If anybody does that, and you come up with some nice conclusions, I'd like you to present those in the Hebrew class too. So,
yeah, Mark.
I was going to ask you about the research paper.
Yes.
I was thinking about doing something on the participle.
Okay.
I was thinking it's probably something that something beyond the extent of a 20-page paper, and it may not be feasible in terms of time and digging around like that to undertake a task like that.
It might be a problem. John, did you happen to even notice when you were doing the participles how often the perfect participles? There were quite a few of them, weren't there?
I would say, as common or more common than the S.
Yeah, so you're probably looking at lots of data.
As common or more common?
That surprises me, but you know, if it's true, it's true. Yeah, so you know, your database gets to you. He had to pull off on the Aris one because the database is getting too big.
Right, and in just a couple months' time, I don't think I'd be able. But what I was wondering is, I think looking at all the topics I've been looking at, that the one I'd like to do is a study of the superlative.
Oh, that would be excellent. I would like to see something done on that, because I've always been a little suspicious of the way the grammars have dealt with that, and they may be right, but I'd like to see a more thorough job done on that. And are you dealing with the superlative exclusively, or comparing with the comparative?
In dealing with the superlative, I'm sure I'll be eventually drawn into looking at the comparative and how that may be used as superlative. I'll have to wait until I do more research to find out exactly how extensive the debate is. And
right.
I know, in just a cursory glance today, that Getches appears to be ultra-liberal, because he just concedes that there's only one true use of it in the New Testament. Flipped open Robertson, and he said there's probably, he says the number is small, but perhaps as many as 15 or 20.
Well, that could open it up a lot more. That'll get it. That's probably a good size of a task to work with, so you can reasonably handle the data that you've got, and maybe get somewhere as well. You know, if you don't have so little that you don't have enough data to make any conclusions, and you don't have so much that you're swamped, you know.